Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Julian Brigden and Ira Harris. Julian is co-founder of Macro Intelligence 2 Partners. His firm publishes independent macroeconomic research. He has over 30 years. His internal team has over 160 years of experience in financial markets, including positions in market and policy-focused consulting to institutional investors, as well as doing fixed income, currency, and commodity sales. Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He's also served as CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is indeed a great pleasure. Richard, it's all yours.
Great. I thought we begin with a view, Julian, on your global macro view on the financial markets and the economy.
Oh, so just a little broad question there to kick things off. I'm mostly focusing on Europe and the US. And what strikes me right here, right now, is that when I look at markets, I still see this, and you can see it in these, you know, the last couple of days with these squeezes that we've got in the equity market. We're at this position in markets where I think people still desperately want to believe that the world is the same. We still want to believe that we're in the trends of the disinflationary trend that we've been in since the early 80s, or certainly the late 80s when the Berlin Wall came down, that somehow the factors of deglobalization, of increasingly a collapse in global trade, of a return to a sort of Cold War, that the pandemic hasn't changed society, which history doesn't support because it always does come through, are all still in place, and that we somehow can vanquish this inflation, that indeed it is in some way, shape or form transitory, or at the very minimum, or at the very most, won't take an awful lot of pain to vanquish, and that we'll all go back to normal and it'll all be great and we'll all rally equities again and bonds yields will remain suppressed and we'll just put everything back into the can and close the lid. And I'm far more skeptical about that, Richard. I just, we've been writing since 2018 about the end of Chimerica, you know, this sort of relationship of symbiotic relationship between China and the US, which was highly disinflationary. We've been writing about how we were coming to a new Cold War, that people didn't really, you know, understand this. We wrote in March of 2020 at the depths of COVID, we have a generational inflection point in macro and it's right now. And I think we are going into one of those periods in history which are definitionally transitory. I mean, we've been in a disinflationary world for basically the last 400 years, but we have bouts of extended inflation that can, on average, have lasted 7 years, but, you know, in the late 60s and 70s, lasted 15 years. Right. And in those periods, you can do an awful lot of damage to your portfolio if you don't understand that we are in one of those definitionally transitory periods, but less transitory than you'd like to think.
Interesting, yeah. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I'm not as model driven, but I certainly come to the same points about where we're at in time. Because again, you know, everybody wants to study just the economy. Me, I look at it through the political economic, because that's the way I was trained. And it's not that I can't get off of there. I can. There, you know, again, I always come back to Louis Gavay's comment. You know, my clients don't pay me to forecast. They pay me to adapt. Now, I adapt for myself. I really don't have clients. I mean, I've gone through that point in life and I enjoy this. And this is just enjoyment, as well as, you know, how I make my living. But you have to adapt to the to what's in front of you. It's like, you know, finance is like a war, and things are always changing. If you think that things are static, you either have a job on Wall Street or you know, you're at the top of the heap, and you think, well, this is, nothing's going to change. But things are changing all the time, and we have to adapt to them. You know, I love Julia's comments, because we do go through those. And yes, we've been, because of the greatness of capitalism as a wealth generating, right? It's what wealth generation is, what it's all about. The politics are, of course, the distribution of that wealth. And it has been since, you know, my favorites are, you know, reading Burdell and people from that ilk who really understand that and how we measure it. So it's the wealth distribution that probably creates more inflation, which is, you know, a lot to do with wars. Wars have a phenomenal impact for many, many, not just the people dying, which is part of it, but of course, the way that they're financed. And in a fiat currency world, which is where we take off. So we're always going to have this. And that's a far greater dynamicism than we've seen in many other ways.
Yeah, there's actually, you'd probably enjoy a couple of papers that were written by the Bank of England. They're a few years old, but they're just, given their timeline, they're still incredibly poignant. And I'm just trying to find, what their titles are, because you will love them.
Thank you.
So the first one is, I don't know how anyone except Bank of England, maybe the Riksbank, who is obviously slightly older than the Bank of England, could get this into the title. Venetians, Volcker, and Value at Risk. 8 centuries of bond market reversals. 8 centuries, right? And the second one is global interest rates since 1311. Okay. Renaissance roots and rapid reversals. And what's interesting, given your prior comments, is this was an analysis of essentially the conditions that create what they call real rate depressions. So extended periods where we've had very, very low real rates. And they go back and they look at history all the way back those 700 years. And they say there are basically 9 real rate depressions. We're currently in the 9th, and this is the 3rd longest in history. And what's interesting is the factors that create them, and then actually more poignantly, the factors that typically end them. And the factors that create them are typically periods of lower global tension, the end of wars, which encourage an increase, a burst of frenetic trade activity, which is obviously disinflationary. Secondly, technological breakthroughs. And I think we tend to be extraordinarily arrogant and assume that we've never seen technological breakthroughs in the past. And, you know, I think you and I would both agree that it's possibly arguable that things like the internal combustion engine, you know, the clipper ship, which opened up fast global trade, might be marginally more important than, you know, cloud computing, right? You know, let's see, but, you know, whatever. But the point is we've had these periods in the past, and they typically ushered in periods of extremely low real rates. So in other words, nominal rates minus inflation. What's interesting, though, is the analysis of what ends those periods. And in every case, it was either a war and or a pandemic. A war and or a pandemic. Obviously, we've had the pandemic. I guess the good news is it wasn't the Black Death and we didn't wipe out 50% of the population, okay? Which led to a huge burst of inflation because there were no workers. But there's no question that coming out of this pandemic, and indeed out of Spanish flu, after the First World War, that you can see that society wants a change. We want a more egalitarian wealth distribution, right? We're demanding it. We want higher wages, right? Because suddenly we see how unequal that distribution is. We want to work from home. There's a cohort who doesn't want to work quite as hard because they've suddenly realized there is an innate vulnerability. And wait a second, I'm in my late 50s and screw this, I'm not going to be around forever. So why should I shackle myself to the corporate horse, right? Or the corporate car. So there's that element of change. And then on the war side, we've been talking about for 4 years at MI2, this natural progression of the end of Chimerica, the end of this sort of symbiotic relations between China and the US, which is in itself highly disinflationary, and how that would lead to a breakdown in globalization. We're amazed, you know, I think I've written four pieces like this, you've kind of won a year on this subject. And every time we write it, I write, oh my God, this thing is happening way quicker than we thought. We thought this would happen over the next 10 years. It just happened last month, right? So we're seeing these breakdowns of these blocks. And I don't think people appreciate, you know, really what ushered in a lot of the disinflation that we've seen in the world really began with the break, with the end of the collapse of communism and the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. That led to a peace dividend, right? So the end of war. That enabled you to shift investment spending from military to the private sector, which is in itself more disinflationary, helps you create that technological burst. It was then exacerbated by, you know, as you open up, the communist countries sort of come online, so to speak, in the capitalist world. Obviously, China being the biggest one, it enters WTO. That once again helps to depress inflation. And you can look at the trend of, you know, CPI basically all the way until 2020, and you can see this dividend coming. Well, if we're going back to this world of blocks, right, where, you know, you won't have the ability of to maximize your output, to really specialize in areas because you will be hemmed in, I think there's a risk, you know, and onshoring and so on is short-term very expensive and probably quite inflationary in its impact, that you have this period of change, of flux. It doesn't mean that I'm a permanent inflationista, because ultimately 400 years we've had disinflation. And at some point, every single job where they're demanding higher wages will be replaced by a nice shiny robot. But it doesn't happen overnight, Ira. It takes time, sir. And so that's why we basically, and you throw in demographics, which we think are changing, which peaked in 2016. We think we're in a bond bear market and in structurally inflationary environment. Doesn't mean you won't get huge swings. The 1960s into 70s, you had huge swings. It just means that the underlying trend is in inflation is up, not down for the next period. And that means you sell fixed income on rallies, you don't buy it on dips. And I think that just creates a very different world going forward.
Yeah, that's some great points. Ira, your thoughts on?
Well, I mean, this is where we're at, and this is the battlefield, you know, so to speak, that we've been given, because I agree totally. You know, 1989, November 9th, 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall. But even prior to that, we had China.
Yeah.
And I talked about it yesterday with Doomberg. You know, when China, once Deng Xiaoping comes to power, and as it is said, as he overcomes Mao's two whatevers, and he goes down a pragmatic path, right? I love his comment, always love his comment, that practice is the sole criterion for judging truth, which unleashes the massive ability of the Chinese people, which had been, you know, we can go back to probably the 1850s and 60s as to when colonialism really set in upon the Chinese mm-hmm. people and the world changed fairly dramatic, but you unleash that power. So I agree with that. And that drove economists, especially the model builders, the mathematicians, the frustrated physicists who were trying to apply those techniques. And they got caught in, of course, with the Phillips curve, which is a totally domestic-oriented assumption. Those assumptions are built. And even when I was in school in the 70s, I could see it. I said, tell me those just don't work, because the globe is changing. And as global capital chases all that unleashed work power, you unleash disinflation on the world, right? Because you have these people who are now anxious to partake in it, and the money is chasing it, and we remove the barriers, right? It's really only with Nixon in 1971, which then it breaks down capital controls, because what's the sense of them? It does, it doesn't work unless you're in a crisis. We unleash all that power, but yet the monetary policy then coupled doesn't understand that. So they do some stupid things. It's like my problem with the Fed right now is they made, it's not what they did. It's just they made such massive wagers with really incomplete information. And now they're trying to roll back that.
Right. I mean, I would extend it beyond the Fed. I mean, I think it really, in fairness to the Fed, and I'm not a Fed fan. Yeah. I'm a central bank skeptic, but and I'll always any opportunity to put the boot in, so to speak, when it comes to criticizing the central banks, I'm pretty much at the front of the line. But I think, in fairness, I mean, the fiscal stimulus that you got in the United States was utterly, utterly out of all proportion. I mean, we put our first inflation trade on in March of 2020. On the 5th of January 2021, we wrote a piece saying inflation is the most important variable of 2021, and it's going a lot higher than you think. And we were working on some models that we built in conjunction with a couple of clients that looked at the aggregate stimulus that you got, both monetary and fiscal. And it was five times bigger, Ira, than anything that we had seen in the post-war period. And this model led inflation by 18 months. And we said, well, doesn't really peak until we get to about now, September of October. And this was at 18 months. And people thought we were nuts. And we said, oh, well, European inflation is going to double digits. And people thought we were. I remember going on a roadshow. And it was a virtual roadshow because it was COVID. And I just had these conversations with people like, Are you sure? You're insane, right? Double-digit European inflation. And I went, yep, that's where I think it's all going. And that's what the models are showing me, and I'm sticking to the models. And now I think that the assumption that many people have, if I looked at the world, I would kind of say there was 15% of people are possibly like you are in the, at least we have a likely that we have a multi-year period of a higher inflation. And I would put that group at about 15%. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's 35%, a dwindling group, that believes that inflation is truly transitory. We're going to wake up tomorrow. These supply factors are all going to rebalance. They don't consider that demand is a driver at all, despite the fact that at Sintra, the European Central Bank offsite, you know, kind of the equivalent of Jackson Hole, the ECB released a paper where they said that in the US, they believe that 2/3 of the inflation was demand driven. And that was something that Governor Waller, Chris Waller, actually agreed with when he did an interview. But there's this group that just believes it's basically supply. Once the bottlenecks are finished, it'll all just evaporate, right? And we'll be back to 2%. I think that group's about 35%. And then the remainder, the nub of the sort of 50%, I think are in the sort of camp that, okay, it's going to be all right. We're going to be able to get things back to 2%. Yeah, it's going to take some pain, but maybe only a shallow recession, and then everything is fine. And history just does not support that thesis one iota. In fact, there was a little article on Yahoo Finance, which I think was written for City AM, one of the newspaper, free newspapers in the UK. And it was a guy who'd taken his kids to the Bank of England Museum. And he said there's a game there called the inflation game. And the inflation game is a filled tube with a ball bearing in. And 2% is in the middle. And you have to balance this tube and get that ball bearing to sit in the middle. And the takeaway from the game is it's bloody hard. Because you tip what you think is not, you know, just about right, and the ball just goes straight to the other end of the tube. And then you go, oh my God, and you tip it back, and then it goes straight to the other end. And yeah. Achieving that balance, I think people are delusional. I mean, we've done some work, and the average decline in the post-war period of inflation, headline inflation, in a recession, right? We're not talking just miraculously wake up and it's all kind of gone away, but the average decline in headline inflation is just under 2%. We're at 8.4 CPI in the US. So that doesn't really get us where we want to be. The only recession that has got us anywhere close to that, with that sort of necessary drop, was 1981 to 1982, where Paul Volcker came in, and to use the analogy, he burnt the house down to cook the dinner. Okay. And I just don't think people realize how incredibly bloody hard this is going to be.
If I guess, so I'm glad that's exactly where you go, because we keep hearing this phrase, the inner Volcker. Now, I just sit and laugh when I hear that. I said, because in today's world, with what the central banks have created, because yeah. The Fed created it, and they ran, as I say in U.S. football parlance, they ran interference
right.
for everybody else. Yep. The ECB could only go there because the Fed was pinned at zero, and therefore going to negative was no big deal. It was no big deal. Especially once you go down unlimited quantitative easing, so you beat off the bond, quote-unquote, vigilantes
yep.
who would have appeared to do the job that they've always been paid to do,
right.
which is direct central banks to where their flaws are. But they didn't know, right? So here we are. We're saddled with it. And I argue that because of that, the massive amount of debt, and because the way I view the world through the world lens of political economy, the Austrians have always been the best at understanding that every crisis really begins with debt.
Right.
There's debt from a war. Debt just leads us into terrible things because you're always trying to figure out how to pay for it, especially as you know, 400 years of disinflation.
Right.
Well, nothing harms debt more than disinflation.
Correct.
You're forever chasing yourself, paying back with more precious currency. So yeah. we're in that. So they have piled us on it. And I say Volcker couldn't be Volcker, because right. when Volcker took on the task after he made the mistakes of trying to remain out of the election of 1980, and he cuts rates a little bit because he doesn't want to be then he goes full force. He couldn't be Volcker today because the huge amount of debt that right. overhangs the entire world is so massive. He could. Do you think you can invert the yield curve to a negative 6%? Not a chance in the world.
No, I mean I think I think this is beginning to hit. Look, I genuinely think that criticism aside, I think these policymakers are serious. Right. Once again, quoting that Sintra thing, that was a very interesting meeting that they had in Portugal, where you had Andrew Bailey, Christine Lagarde, and Jay Powell. And they did an interview, all three of them together, and they said, they kind of held hands and sang Kumbaya, and then they went, we're going to defeat this inflation. And I genuinely, genuinely believe that these people viscerally want to defeat inflation. I think Powell is a genuine individual where he says, what has enabled us to succeed has been the ability, when we get downturns, to cut rates, to spur economic growth, to not have to worry about the underlying inflation risks. Right? That's enabled us to keep this cycle going. And I truly think that he, I've been told that, you know, at a meeting back at the end of last year, just as they started to get hawkish, that November 2021 meeting, I was told that he, that all the members of the FOMC came into the meeting and on their desk was a manila folder containing the minutes from the Arthur Burns Federal Reserve from the late 60s. And Jay Powell said, we are not going to be an Arthur Burns Fed. Okay. And I think it's important, just as a side note for your readers or your listeners to remember, you know, when they start to hear all these noises about, you know, fracture in the FOMC and some, they get some dovish reads, that is, it is not a democracy, the FOMC. Right. Some central banks are truly democracies where everyone essentially gets a vote. That is not how the FOMC works. If you do not like how the chair votes, then you can dissent. Okay? It is not a democracy. And Jay Powell, I think, genuinely wants to try and tackle this. But to go back to your point, I think the, and they also want to desperately avoid the stop-go economics that goes with the 1960s and that and 70s, because it is really volatile and it's hugely, hugely destructive. The problem is in the same way that I look at history and I say, we've had these periods before, where do the dots line up? Yeah, it's not a given deal that we definitely go there, but what does, on balance, what do the dots tell us? I think that, you know, we forget that, I think, you know, we've had these excesses in the system. The global financial crisis was the first manifestation of it in terms of a crisis. Maybe you could argue the dot-com bubble to some degree, but really in terms of economic terms, it was the GFC. And we've kind of lurched from one to the other. And we've been constantly trying to your point, play interference, the central banks trying to avoid the natural outcome. But there's a natural gravitational force there that if you can't offset it, right? We are in a deglobalizing world. We are in a world that's now post the pandemic that wants to see structural change in terms of society, wants to see a more egalitarian share of society. Those factors are generally inflationary. They weigh on productivity, all of these other factors. And I think what concerns me is exactly the point that you raised. It's the ability of these central banks to actually deliver what they want, because, and you're starting to get a sense of that amongst, within the FOMC. You got a paper recently, which Lael Brainard highlighted, where they talked about this thing called R double star. Okay, what is R double star? Well, R star, the original R, okay, is essentially the rate at which the real economy is balanced versus rates, right? What is the level of rates where the real economy is in balance? Okay, R double star is what is the level of rates where the financial economy is balanced. And in your world, Ira, of excessive financialization, excessive debt, the biggest threat, I believe, and the biggest impediment for us, for our ability to actually structurally take on inflation right here, right now, which is what Powell is trying to do, is if, which my suspicion is definitely the case, our double star is below our star. Because what that actually means is they will try and hang tough. They will try and do the right thing. They will try and prevent a return to the 1960s, where they lurch from one extreme to the other, where you get that boom bust, where the policy response is what was called stop-go economics, right? But if our double star is lower, what will happen is the financial markets will break before you've had a chance to wring out that underlying inflation trend. And what will happen is the markets will collapse. They will then be forced to come in and act. And the cycle will take off again, and you won't wring it out. And that was actually the lesson of the late 1960s and 1970s, that the cycle of inflation was a big cycle. It was really incredibly volatile, but the lows were continuously higher until Paul Volcker came in and said, enough is enough. And we aren't in that point now. Maybe in 10 years from now, when the real value of the debt has been eroded by inflation, we'll be in a situation to go, right now, but from what level of inflation? 10, structurally underlying at that point? 12? I mean, are we going back to the Volcker highs? You know, 16 or whatever the heck it was, right? I don't know. But I do worry that we have a world that's built on this assumption that we go back to normal.
Yeah.
Everything goes back into the can. We close the lid. 2%, right. Great equity markets, great yeah. bond markets, global stability. Wouldn't that be nice? Because that's what we've had for the last, 40 years, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah. I know. It's such a phenomenal point on that R double star. And I think that you bring up that Brainerd. Now, I love that you go to Cintra, because I think that Bloomberg interview with the three, plus Augustin Karstens as on that yeah. panel.
Yes.
Now, I have great respect for Augustin Karstens, and he made the point. And that's what really, you know, if you know, he understands the impact of this again on the emerging market world. Yeah. And you're going to go this route, but because everybody said, well, the emerging market currencies aren't really moving that much. That's because the emerging markets have seen this and they go, we can't let the 70s retake ourselves. When right. we took a beating, we were loaded with debt as we were financing our oil imports, and then the world fell apart, which again, who saw that? The Marxists and the Austrians really saw that yeah. coming. The Chicago people, they never saw that coming, because that's right. not what they focused on. But and it exists out there. And, you know, I don't know what the timeline is either, but I think it's so fascinating because we are seeing a breakdown of what kept prices under control, right?
Right.
Because unions had no power. They were broken in the early 80s. They were done, except for public sector unions, but yep. that's a whole different story. But private sector unions and wages, I mean, look, Donald Trump's election wasn't a mistake, because it was all those people who had failed to sustain themselves through that period
Correct.
Of time, you know, and Walmart wasn't going to keep them happy forever. So we did see wages.
It's, yeah. it's,
and so, I mean, so, given this environment that and all of these factors, like how do you see the bond market? You mentioned before our beginning, you're bearish on the bond market. Can you go through the specific?
Yeah, no, market? I mean, look, it, you know, yeah. We've sort of remained bearish. It's not been easy to trade as you would think. I mean, you know, back in 2020, late 2020, I think it was November 2020, we sold euro dollars. I mean, they were pricing in nothing. The risk, you know, this is front end contracts in the US. It was one of the easiest layup trades. And then we did Euribor, which is the European equivalent. Then we did Sonia's, which is the UK equivalent. And, you know, holding on to the positions hasn't been overly easy. And particularly since you've been this kind of tug of war that you end up with the equity market, where you go, okay, now the equity market's going, I better buy back at least the front end of the bond market, right? Because that's how, you know, you balance that kind of trade out. But structurally, the long end of the bond market, I've just remained very, very wary of. I truly believe we're in a structural bear market. I think when you look at demographics tell you we're in a structural bear market. I think a lot of people get this story wrong on the demographic story. They look at, say, Japan, and they say, well, what happens is when you get older, you spend less money, and as a result, inflation's lower and bond yields are lower. What they actually forget is that it's not the spending of the money that dictates what happens to bond yields, or indeed to stock prices. It's the savings, because you don't buy the asset from your spending, you buy the asset out of your pool of savings. And then when you model it from that side, so just the other side of the coin, essentially, what you realize is when you model, say, the buyers of US Treasuries, so everyone who runs a current account surplus, who puts money into Treasuries, plus the US itself, and you model those demographics, you get a kind of nice sine wave that runs up into the highs of bond yields. I'm just putting up the chart here so I get the dates exactly right. That runs up into the highs of, as the sort of baby boomers were in school. It runs up into basically 1980. So in school, they're consumers, right? Indirectly, right? And so bond yields rise because they're not saving. They hit 1980 and they hit their peak earnings potential and they start to save. And this is happening globally, not just in the US, right? And that runs to 2016. And in 2016, I think we hit the zenith of that savings metric, right? The Japanese actually were net savers up until very, very recently, right? Because they, you know, this is an aging population. And yeah, sure, they were retiring, but a lot of them never really retired, right? You would retire as one of the sort of suits in the big Japanese corporations. And then the following day you would turn up again, but not as an employee, as a consultant, right? So you kept going for a long time. And we know that the Japanese are very healthy. You know, there's these pictures of these exoskeletons where the little farmer, you know, reaches up to pick the plum that goes off to Tokyo to get sold for $20, right? Because it's just a perfect plum. It's very Japanese, but that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they actually didn't stop. They didn't start to dissave until very recently. And this is the point. We've hit this zenith of the kind of dissaving now. So I think that's a big structural, and we'll just see this thing gradually rise over the next 30 odd years. Now, is that supportable? Maybe, as long as real rates don't rise too much, right? Could we end up with a situation where central banks are forced to come in and do kind of yield curve control again, like you guys obviously saw down in Australia? You know, that I think is a possibility. But the point is, the pressure is up. Short term, you know, if you go back to it, short term, I have been actually, you know, we flagged for our fourth quarter trading outlook, you know, and gilt yields at the time were sitting around 350. We said, I really don't like this setup on gilts. And we started to look at the charts, and we do that as we set up our trades. It's just one of the, you know, of our aids to a trade. And we drew a channel, which was 375 to 5%. And we said, if 30-year gilts go through 375, the next level is 5%. And of course they did. And one of my clients came back and joked, and he said, Julian, when you said, you know, if we break 375, we could go to 5, I didn't think you meant intraday, which is obviously what happened, right? So when I look around and I look at the setups in the bond markets, I see kind of similar things. I mean, we've broken 40-year trend lines in US treasuries all along the curve, from 2s to 30s. Right, that's 40 year of bull market price action is gone. Doesn't mean we can't, you know, doesn't mean it couldn't be a false break, but this stuff is extending now beyond that level. We're coming up to a 30 year trend line on 10 year bund futures, which if it breaks will give you another 100 basis points on bund yields. I'm watching JGBs, 30 year JGBs, which is the one part of the curve where Kuroda doesn't control. We've got inflation, I think, tomorrow night. I'm very worried that we're going to print, you know, Kuroda once again is maintaining that inflation is transitory. With this level of dollar yen, and if you were to, God forbid, get oil prices back to 110, let's say, you would have at least 4% headline inflation, you know, ex-food inflation in Japan. And do I really, really want to own 30-year JGBs at 1.5% in an environment where the central bank is doing, I mean, at least the Fed is doing something to preserve the value of bondholders' assets by raising rates, but neither the ECB or the BOJ is doing that. Why would I want to own the long end of their bond market? And the problem is, in that environment is, and we just talked about this before, people forget why bond yields in the US got as low as they did. And in many respects, it wasn't because the Fed necessarily wanted them to get there. It was because of the trillions of dollars that poured out of Europe and Japan seeking yield as both of those central banks went to negative interest rates. And if those dynamics start to reverse, then this effect, which is fungibility, right? So the ability to turn you know, like a magician, turn a JGB into a treasury or a treasury into a gilt, right? By buying it and then doing a currency hedge against it to offset the cash flows, right? And it's the sovereign bond market is incredibly interchangeable in that sense. I mean, that's what fungibility kind of means. If those yields in the rest of the world go higher, they are going to take US treasuries along for a ride. And I think this is what people don't understand. Yeah, sure, at some point, if we truly crack the equity market, and my target on the S&P is like 3,000, on the NASDAQ, it's like 7,000. If we truly crack the equity market, then sure, bonds will be a buy again. Right? But I just view them at this point as basically a free put on the US equity market. Otherwise, you just sell them. And I think for the next 40 years on every major rally, you sell fixed income. Unless Powell is truly able, and we just discussed this, I'm afraid he might not be able to because of this setup between R double star and R star. In other words, the ability to really tighten and to a level that is commensurate with wringing inflation out of the real economy as opposed before you break the financial economy. I don't think that's possible. I can't get bullish on fixed income structurally.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, no, I mean, we pick up from there. So, you know, everybody wants to look at Japan in the 80s, 90s, aughts, and I go, it's a foolish argument. First of all, Japan was one of the only places to really experience deflation. So when JGB yields dropped to 60 basis points, 50 basis points, 97% of the Japanese bond market was owned by Japanese domestics.
Right.
They were getting the full advantage of that deflation. So we could live with it because real yields were probably 2.5%, 2%. In the United States, we haven't seen real positive yields I would probably say the fourth quarter of 2018, which became a very important point because, yes, the measure of inflation was 1.7 and we got yields to 2.5 to 2.75. And honestly, I don't care about the long end per se, because the banks can't really control the long end unless they go to a yield curve type mechanism.
Yep.
If you want to battle inflation, Volcker showed them you do it on the short end. I will squeeze money so tight overnight in the funding markets that you will stop lending. And it happened.
And you will feel it, yes.
You will feel it. And you saw that in the fourth quarter of 2018. And then it was interesting because at Jerome Powell's last press conference of last week of September,
yep,
the last question came from that woman, and she said, you know, where do Fed funds have to go? And Jerome Powell said, I'd like to see a real 1%, real positive 1% of Fed funds to inflation. Well, if I'm a John Taylor person, that means that the Fed funds should, I guess, be at about 7.5%.
Right.
So, but we're not, will we ever get there? I am scared. There's no way, because you will break the back of the global financial. I mean, it's just, I don't think
the leverage is just too great in the system.
Right. And the leverage is there because, and that's what their models also don't show, how much leverage is in the system. You created quantitative easing. And don't forget, we only stopped in March of 2022.
Yeah.
They were on full, basically.
And the BOJ is still doing it.
The BOJ is still doing it. And we don't know what the ECB is doing because Christine Lagarde, who's a politician more than anything
else,
brought in to handle the politics of what was coming. You know, Draghi did what Draghi did, and he had the help of the Fed. Now Lagarde has to fight the Fed, and she made it known. And, you know, I don't care about what Joachim Nagel and the Hanseatic Five, they can talk about, well, we have to get the quantitative tightening. But Christine Lagarde, let it be known, I'll raise rates, but we're not even thinking about, as she would say, quantitative tightening.
This is the stupidity, right? We've been saying that, you know, European inflation would get to double digits. I mean, I don't think, you know, if you look at, say, the spread between, look, I'm pretty bearish when I look at the adjustments that are going to happen in Europe. I think that, you know, on balance, if you look at how do we get where we are in terms of nominal GDP back to a more balanced level. So in other words, growth plus inflation. There are kind of three ways that you can do it. You can drop real growth, you can drop inflation, or you can just raise rates a lot, right? I don't think they can raise rates very much. I don't think inflation is coming down. I think it's probably going up again. I mean, we have a, this is, if you don't watch this thing, we have a 37%, right? Absolute 37% spread between Eurozone or German PPI and German CPI, right? Now, if it disappears tomorrow, great, but I don't think it does. If the German corporate sector has to eat it, then there is not a single cent of profit in the DAX, not one. The whole of corporate Germany is bankrupt, okay? So they're going to pass some of it on to the degree that they can. So you're going to get, I think, mid-teens inflation rates in Europe, in Germany, and you think that you want to own 30-year German bonds at 2.5%, and the central bank that you just said, Ira, is not willing, the Fed is at least willing to get in there and for now at least hang tough. They are protecting the value of a long-term bond holder from the vagaries of inflation, right? They're saying, we're going to wring this out of the system. Whether you believe ultimately they can or not is immaterial. They're walking the walk. The ECB is meandering the walk at best. At best.
Yeah, 100%. And she is caught here in a big way. You know, Draghi did what, but again, Draghi had the Fed running the interference for him, because as long as U.S. rates were pinned at zero, you know, and we saw when they would move away again, 2018 becomes a very interesting situation. And then you saw, even before the onset of COVID, Draghi couldn't, Powell couldn't pivot fast enough again, because the global ramifications, the dollar started moving up and things, and it was making life difficult. Forget equity, you know, of course we saw the drop in equity markets, but he ran tail as fast as he could. And I think it, now he's trying to compensate for it. And I understand that, but it's, I don't know. And I guess this is where it takes us. The fragility of the global system is probably at its highest for so many reasons.
Yeah.
Since probably the late 70s and early 80s, but it was for a different reason. But again, I concentrate and look at, wow, debt has just exploded, and exploded for the right reason. And I look, I think, Julian, I'm not sure how you would look at this, but I look at what happened in January of 2015 with the Swiss National Bank, right? When the S&P and the Swiss put in that peg at 120 on the Euro Swiss, and it was sacrosanct. It was so sacrosanct that when somebody got a 119.99 print on the EBS system, the Swiss National Bank said, no, it can't be, because we're on the bid. We're buying
everything. Yeah, we're buying everything, right?
We're buying everything. You can't, you know, it's like being in the pit and a guy's going, I'm bid. And somebody tries to get a low ball tick in there. They couldn't get it in there, probably because they had some knockout options that needed to be exercised. And they made a stance about it. And then a week later, they pulled up it. And then you saw what happened. All these people who had been sold this bill of good by their bankers, they got a Swiss franc mortgage. The Swiss are holding.
All the Polish and Czech and everything, right?
Right. We're still fighting those lawsuits because people took a bath on it. But and why? Because there was so much debt written in Swiss francs. And and that's what scares me. I think that's my greatest fear, because I look at that and I go, look what happens. And it's probably to a factor of 10 when you look at the impact of what's going on with dollar borrowings. So how far can they go? And I agree with it. That's what makes me nervous about the U.S. bond market, because people are giving the Fed that right now, I think they're right. They're pricing the bond market. The curve's inverted because you're going, well, the Fed is going to sustain itself. We hear from them. But if I go back to the double R star, and it's interesting, that it comes from Brainerd. Right. Because I think there will always be a battle right now in this Fed. I think if you asked her, Leo Brainerd would probably tell you, I deserve to be chair.
Oh, yeah, definitively. Right? And that's what she was after when she joined.
Oh, yeah, absolutely after when we thought she was going to be Secretary of Treasury, because the New York Times ran that article back right after the Biden election. And I, you know what? I didn't have a problem with it. I was kind of surprised that they came back to Powell to be chair, by the way. But I talked to some people who supposedly were involved in the vetting of them.
Yep.
And what impressed Biden's left was that Powell was the first chair who was most concerned about jobs, right? We heard it from during COVID. You know, he was, as I would write in my blog, he was the Minister of Social Justice, because he adamantly said that anybody who lost a job through no fault of their own, we're going to pursue this tack until everybody has a job.
Right.
And here we are. And he did. Right. And he pursued that. And that's why the Biden team loved him.
Right.
Because he was concerned.
We called it the wokeism of the Fed, right? They just became utterly woke, right?
Right. No.
I said at the time, I said, look, you know, you can't disagree with it socially, right? I mean, societally, this is a fantastic thing.
Right.
I just said to people, it's just going to have consequences for the market. And, you don't take a stance on whether it's right or wrong. And I would argue it's right. Right? I'm a kind of, by American standards, I live over here. I'm a pinky liberal, right? Because I agree with things like sort of universal healthcare and universal education, right? But, you know, that's kind of as far as I go, but that's a very British sort of right-wing sort of stance. But it's very pink by, you know, it's very left-wing by American standards. But I just said, look, this just has consequences for the market when you pursue these policy objectives. Not that they're wrong. You just got to understand, right? When Trump came in and decided that he was going to push through an unnecessary fiscal stimulus in an economy that was already running hot, it looked exactly like Lyndon Johnson's, you know, Great Society spending in the mid 60s, right? Where you didn't need it. The economy was fine. It didn't need a kicker, right? And then that just led to this sort of what we call this accelerative oscillation in the cycle, where the central bank kind of got behind the ball, where essentially they were trading a negative gamma position, where they go from this nice kind of positive gamma position where they're long on the rally and, you know, short on the dip, and they just sort of control the oscillation of the economic cycle around that long-term trend of, you know, call it 1.75 GDP growth, real GDP growth, to all of a sudden the cycle overshoots on the top side, and then they're really tightening really hard, which is like buying the top when you have when you're short options, and then the market collapses on them and they're selling the lows, and the cycle just gets bigger and bigger in the oscillations. And that's actually what happens, and that's actually why I'm afraid. I wrote at the very end of last year for 2022, I think this is the year of, we're going back to boom bust economics. Very tough environment.
I agree. And it's interesting, you call yourself a pinky liberal, but it was the same with Janet Yellen. And Janet Yellen is a labor economist. And as I would say, her desire, and with the whole Fed listens things when she would go out with the labor, and she's a labor economist. And you're right. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. As much as he was an economist, he was a moral philosopher, and Janet Yellen was a moral philosopher. And I have no problem with that, because, right, I'm a big believer that employment is a very important thing for so many different. But I want a hard, sound money person running the Fed. I don't want a moral philosopher.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm a Thatcherite. Right? I was an adamant Thatcherite, right, as a kid. But, you know, by comparison to American right wing these days, that makes me a pinky liberal. You know, we've swung so far that side. I'm a total believer in free markets. I'm an utter capitalist to the bone. But I think we need to level the playing fields a little bit. Otherwise, society becomes unbalanced. So, you know, anyway, I think we're still dealing with those consequences. And I think that, as I said, my concern is everyone just assumes this is going to be very easy to rebalance, and that we're going to be able to do it without many consequences. And yet you hear Powell, who, as I said, I think he's being genuine. I think he's determined. I'm not sure he's really going to be able to deliver. My gut is he's not going to be able to deliver, because I think the pain is going to be too acute for everything we've talked about, the financialization of the system, where our double star is, the risk to the financial markets, that they will never get to that point. But I think he's really determined to try and deliver. And that just has now intense consequences. And I think that's what we're trading here. And I think it'll swing very violently at some point the other way. And you've just got to be prepared for that. And it makes it for a bloody, bloody hard trading environment, right? And the central banks keep coming in and they keep coming up with these, what they think are these long-term fixes. You were talking about the SMB. I mean, the RBA is a classic example with yield curve control, right? That's it, right? Just go away, shut up, stop talking about it. It's here forever. No, it's not. Right? And, you know, it was so obvious that the, you know, what was interesting is when you looked at last summer and you saw countries like Australia, you saw countries like the Czech Republic and Poland start to raise rates by 100 basis points. And yet you were seeing the ECB and the Fed just sort of vacillate. And you said, well, why don't they, what are they seeing that the Poles and the Aussies are, what are they not seeing that the Poles and the Aussies are seeing? And the answer was nothing. They were all seeing the same thing. It's just, it's a lot more dangerous when you start to act like that as the Fed. And we're seeing the consequences of what happens when the Fed starts to act and go, no, it's 75 and it's going to be another 75. And I just think people are really overestimating how easy this is going to be. Apparently, there's a paper doing the rounds today. Well, actually, not a paper. It was the internal Fed forecasts are now doing the rounds, saying they're really worried that productivity may be significantly lower. And as a result, the output gap is actually much tighter than they think. And this economy is really now operating way, way, way above trend. And so rates will have to go even higher. And I've just looked at this stuff, Ira, and I just said, like I said, you know, if you go back and you look at the ability of a recession to deliver a slowdown in inflation, it's actually far less than you would imagine it can deliver. And I looked at where nominal GDP is, so in other words, real growth versus and inflation, and you look at it against trend. Nominal GDP in absolute terms, not the rate of change, in absolute terms, is, I think, about 6.5% above trend. And there is not a single recession in the post-war period, absent COVID, which has delivered a slowdown of that magnitude. And by the way, that would only get us back to trend, right? Let alone deliver the pain that Powell keeps, you know, just sort of gently reminding people of, right? I mean, this is going to be a Herculean task. So the idea of a pivot, the idea that we get back to normal, the idea that I can buy stocks at 3,800 and they're going back to 4,800, and I desperately need to make sure I catch the low, which you can see in the behavior of the markets is exactly that mentality where they leap on everything. Oh, the Bank of England's doing YCC. Oh, the Treasury's going to do, you know, some sort of buyback operation. So that really is QE again. And up we rally again. You can see that that mentality is still utterly pervasive in the market, that the central banks are really not the enemy. They're my friend. And I've tweeted, no, they're actually your sworn enemy now. They are your nemesis if you're a risk-on investor.
And just a final...
Richard, if I can... Okay, yeah. So, you know what? I love that. And I read that Greg Torres piece from Bloomberg this morning, and I go, and that was the first thing I went, as I read it, and people, I read it twice, I go, oh, so we're back to output gaps? What, you know what? Bernanke got the Nobel Prize, and now everybody's going to morph their way back to output gaps? This is, you know, I thought the piece was almost a counter piece to what was in the New York Times, which you cited yesterday, which I think you're 100% right. I wonder where this comes from. Everybody says, well, Nick Timiraos got got pushed to the back of the queue here, and the New York Times run. But that probably came from Raynard, this piece. Somebody's always talking to somebody, you know.
Yeah.
So I love that. And then to couple with it, and, you know, for all those who get really conservative and, you know, oh, I'm this, I'm that, you know, Hayek himself believed in a social safety net.
Right.
Schumpeter, who's another one of my favorites, they believed in social safety nets. You can't run a democratic society without that. The brutality of unfettered free market capitalism is a myth that only exists at, well, you're living in Chicago, so it's at 57th and Woodlawn. So it doesn't exist. So how do we adapt? That's the politics, right?
Yeah.
Economics is the study of the creation of wealth, and political economy is the distribution of the wealth.
Right.
And how we deal with it is how you and I make our living.
Yes, correct, sir.
And just a final question.
Yes, sir.
Given a lot of the volatility that you mentioned, what do you see as the best strategy for across different asset classes?
It's extraordinarily hard. I mean, if we come out the other end of this and you preserve the real value of your wealth, not grown it, just preserved it, you'll have done extraordinarily well. Certainly on a relative basis, you are going to be a king amongst men, right? I mean, there is no question. This is a phase where the system destroys wealth. Okay, it destroys wealth. So when I look at stuff, my long-term assumption is that at some point central banks will pivot, because they'll collapse the financial system far sooner, and we will get another risk rally. I don't know whether, I mean, maybe it's possible that we get to a point where they just kind of, soft landing is a ridiculous concept, but we get financial markets to a point where they can say, okay, we've got them to where we want them to be, and that maybe we don't, then they just leave policy where it is. We don't get that classic, what we've had since 2008, where we get that reflexive cycle again, where you go, you hit a low, and then they don't only stop tightening, they just start re-easing again. Okay, so maybe we don't get one of those, but I kind of assume we will, if just because of the leverage in the system and how much damage we're going to do in trying to pursue a tightening in the real economy, that they will have to pivot. And at that point, my gut is that things like the dollar start to really drop significantly lower. And then I want to be in tangible real assets. I want to own my precious metals. I want to own my gold. I want to own my emerging markets. I want to own emerging market equities. I want to own my commodity stocks. I want to own all of that kind of stuff. I probably want to own, you know, Australia and Canada in the developed world. You know, I want to own Canadian mining, little mining stocks that are just going to explode, you know, 50-fold. And generally, I want to be short the US, which I still think has got an equity bubble of inordinate proportions. But we're not there yet. So right here, right now, what have I got? I've got some of those plays on, but in small. And whenever you get a risk-off situation, I try and sell the NASDAQ and the S&P against those positions. So I run relative value trades. I've quite a lot of cash. I've got a lot of cash, but and I put it in very short-dated money markets so that it can be deployed kind of whenever I need it. I'm almost all in dollars, completely in dollars. I got caught out a little bit in some sterling stuff, but, you know, I'm a Brit. I always have to have some nub of cash there.
Okay.
So it's a very, very defensive environment. And I think people forget that if you go and look back at times where, you know, if you look at the 2000 dot-com bubble, which is, I really think, is the best analogy from an equity perspective that we've got going on in the US. I think this was a valuation bubble, an irrational exuberance bubble. It's not like the GFC in that sense. you know, until 2002, until you started to get into recession in the US and the Fed truly pivoted and the dollar started to weaken, that even being long the things that you wanted to own, ultimately, silver, you know, was one of the best trades, you know, gold, resources, all of those things. Initially, they all went down. Everything went down, and by not small amounts, right? I think silver dropped from, I mean, like 475 to the low, I think, in early 2002, like 375 or something, right? So you, even if it outperformed the S&P and the NASDAQ on a relative basis, you still got ding. So unless you can play those relative games where you short something and long another, it's mm-hmm. cash is probably your best bet, unless you're lucky enough to have locked in debt, which is really only a US thing, you know, 30-year debt or 15-year debt, you know, at whatever rate, right? And you can sit here and allow inflation to erode it.
Yeah.
Great, then. Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
I'm just moving to Bachelor Gulch and hanging out in that cabin because Julie and I are, I mean, I'm really running the same view, but I put more stake on, again, I stay with my eye towards the metals. I said gold will probably go down to, if Powell succeeds in getting the real yields positive by 1.5%, and I can go back and look in 2018, you know, gold had, here, just so we don't have to guess, gold during that period of getting real yields higher.
Talking real Fed funds, right?
Right, real Fed funds.
So you got up to, like, I've got the chart here, you got up to 90 basis points, basically.
In 2018.
Right? Yeah, we're still, by the way, this is what people, I took this chart back on Bloomberg as far as I could get it. I can get it to like 1954.
Yep.
The lows that we saw, 1975, we got to minus 5%. 1980, we got to minus 5. And we're still minus 0.57. So we're still easier than we've been at any point since 1955. So if people think it's all over, and then as I said, you go back to this, how do you reprice this real yield? You know, is it all going to be a drop in inflation, right, which would obviously raise real yields, or are they actually going to have to rate hike them more than you think? And that's kind of my fear.
I agree. And do they have the stomach for it? Now, I just don't, you know, that's where the break point is going to be. Do they have the stomach for it?
Well, they have the stomach until something breaks, Ira, right? And then, you know, this is a colleague of mine did an interview with Thomas Hoernig, who's like the longest standing Fed governor in the post-war period. And he said, look, I think Powell's kind of doing the right thing. He said, but we haven't really had the test yet of how girded his loins are, right? Because we haven't had that situation where unemployment's higher and inflation still hasn't been licked, right? At that point where you've got materially higher unemployment and inflation hasn't been licked, what do they do? Does he keep going? Paul Volcker, burn the house down to cook the dinner? Or do politics get in the way? Reality, right?
100%. So all those investable things, you know, agricultural is hanging up far better than people, you know, those stocks which got killed during COVID. But I would argue that the agricultural curve, meaning we are going to be saddled with higher prices only because the world has changed, you know. And one of the things with agricultural products is that even when they were talking about supply bottlenecks, We were running through 20 and 21 during COVID, record crops from Brazil to the U.S., and yet prices remained the same. And that, to me, was because of China. China now, when we haven't even discussed it, is a bigger problem because the yuan is weakening. I'm a big fan of Michael Pettis. And the yuan ought not to be weakening because China definitely wants a more domestic-oriented economy.
Yep.
And it's a curse to have a weak currency. This is not the model that built China. They'd like to have, but the currency is weakening for other reasons. And during COVID, it strengthened because who was buying everything? The Chinese were buying it. They stockpiled everything, copper, steel. So the world is definitely changing. And the question we're left with, and it's not about soft landing 100%. I can't agree with you more. Hard landing, what breaks, as Jimmy Bianco has so beautifully discussed over and over. Him, you know, I know you and Bianco and Buchvar and others have, for the last year and a half, been pointing, you know, that the Fed was going into a dangerous situation because owners' equivalency rent was going to kill them anyway. So as they were sitting here with transitory, anybody who's looking at the data goes, no. And it almost makes me cry that I'm reading Craig Torres' piece today, this morning, and I'm glad you brought it up because it caught your eye too. And we're talking about output gaps. We're going backwards again to that. Good, bad.
That's why I go back to this, you know, that I started off with this history lesson from the Bank of England, right? I mean, we all tend to be myopically focused. I mean, people like, you know, me who sit in front of a screen, you know, all day tend to be very, very myopically focused. And I've got clients who are even, you know, to the tick myopically focused. And we tend to forget the bigger picture lessons of history.
Yeah, no. And then how to invest with them. And I think your bond outlook, and again, these curves need to, they're gonna, well, I think the tell will be when the US curve starts to steepen.
But the bull steepener, Ira, right? Where the bull steepener, where 2-year yields start to fall.
Yep.
Because what happened relative to the long end, because what happened is that's when the bond market is telling you, I know, Fed, you think you're going to be able to get rates to 4.75, but I'm just telling you, mate, there's no way you are. This economy is going to be in a deep recession before you get there. And we're not there yet, right? We are clearly not there yet.
Yeah. And just to end there, just running out on a time constraint here, if that's okay, we can continue the discussion for another podcast if you like. It's been fascinating. Can you give an idea, Julian, how our listeners and viewers can learn more about your work?
Yeah, so sure. You know, if you're an institutional client and you'd like to know more about us, then you can contact us at support@mi2partners.com. So support@mi2partners.com. If you're retail and you'd like to find out my views, you can follow us on, we do a joint venture with Real Vision. Once again, you can access that at support@mi2partners.com and we'll set you up. And if you just want to follow me casually, then follow me at JulianMI2 on Twitter.
Awesome. And Ira.
Well, now the holidays are past. I'm going to really get aggressive in writing the blog, okay. Notes from Underground. And I'm looking to open up, really, Julian, with you, much more of a dialogue. I know Andrew's been pushing me. Oh, you are so simpatico. And I think you would agree with it. It's not about a matter of being simpatico. We can talk and we can disagree, and we'll learn more from our disagreements than we will learn ever from what we agree with. And I will just caution all the listeners who listen to this, because I think if we do another podcast, but there was a piece written in the Washington Post the other day, and it may be where the political breakpoint comes and meets the Fed. The cost of financing the deficit now and the debt is going to impinge upon the budget. And in the U.S. budgetary process, which is far different than the Brits.
Yeah.
This is where the politics, you know, again, going back to Johnson's Great Society, he had to buy off the liberal wing with the butter so that he could get the guns.
Well, you could see it today. I mean, it's just yesterday, there was a story that they want to roll childcare. And the Republicans were like, okay, well, if you do that, we want the accelerative depreciation allowances to continue, right? I mean, this is a very pork barrel-y orientated U.S. system that where fiscal, you know, I like to say this, you know, when Donald Trump came in, the biggest thing that he did was he persuaded the system that fiscal rectitude was gone, right? They took the fiscal hawks out to the back of the bike shed and they shot them through the forehead. And now everyone just wants to spend money.
Amen. Yep. And that's where we're at. And it doesn't matter. And so when will the break point come? And that's what Powell's up against. And whoever yep. sits in that seat, it's a political seat. This was great. Thank awesome. You, Richard.
Yeah. Pleasure.
Thank you so much, Julian and Ira. Yeah, we'll continue with another podcast.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thank you, Julian. Really appreciate
Take
it.
Take care, yeah.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.